This is a podcast for Wednesday, November 9th, 2011. Ethics. And I think I've got this new fancy recorder. I just haven't been using it because I'm not sure. I want to make sure that I haven't taken any recordings off of this thing yet, so I want to make sure it's working, but I might as well do this too. Yeah, no, I was thinking you get pulled over by public safety. Oh, I better record this altercation, you know, for further evidence. I'll pull out my recorder. You got a stun gun. Yeah. These are like little microphones. So, okay. And I screwed up once already. You have to press the recording button twice in order to get it to record, which is really irritating. I think I really need to turn that off. So I like lost one of my recordings, because I was recording, it was on pause. Okay. And this hopefully will pick up you guys a little better, too. This is kind of ghetto. My last recorder got busted, so. The Zoom H4N. It's supposed to be top of the line for the handheld recorders, and it's only about $280, so not too shabby. You can use, independent films with this. It's got XLR jacks for you audio geeks. You can plug it into, a real sound system. Okay. Oh, so deontology and utilitarianism. So what? Do you remember any of the arguments? I don't want to put you on the spot there, but is anything that come to mind is some arguments that I made or somebody else made that seemed like they were really Kantian type deontology type arguments, or?
Well, the main thing was just that the rich should pay for higher taxes to help everybody, or the middle class, which is the majority, and because of that, or helping them, then they can become better productive members of society, and then everybody as a whole is better off.
Right, so what kind of argument would that be? That would be more Kantian or utilitarian? Utilitarian, right? Hey, if we all pay if the rich pay more, then that's going to allow the poor who can't afford education to get an education, and they'll become rich too, and we'll have a more productive society. And and these rich guys, they got a lot of money to spare, and so what's this rich SOB going to do? He's going to buy another yacht. was one of my lines. And if he wants to send his kid to Harvard, and then I made another argument. I said, hey, if he wants to send his kid to Harvard, the least he can do is throw a few dollars to the community college to allow someone to send their kid to college too. Even though it's not Harvard, at least it's going somewhere. So then when you switch over to talk about what someone ought to do, what their obligations are, what their responsibility is. I use this phrase, social responsibility. That's more of a deontology argument. You talk about a person's rights and responsibility. I also said education is a basic right. And anytime you're talking about basic rights, that's more deontology. Because remember, utilitarianism, you don't really have any rights. Rights, if and when they exist, are conditional on the greatest happiness for the greatest number. So you can kind of have a faux conventional sense of rights. You might say, let's say legal rights. You might say, I have a right to free speech. Well, under utilitarianism, you don't have any absolute rights for anything. But you might get a legal right to free speech. And John Stuart Mill actually argues that it's better for society that you allow free speech, because then you get good speech as well as bad speech. And censorship is a lot worse than any damage that would be done to society by free speech. So it's all about the consequences. Whereas Kant would say, I don't know, I haven't read a lot about what Kant's views on freedom of expression or free speech. But I think a Kantian type argument would be, you have a right to free speech, and that right is absolute and near absolute. I mean, kind of like the First Amendment. It says, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech. And so it's an absolute thing. You can't pass laws, and you can't say, okay, well, generally you have free speech, but the Klan, forget it, you guys can't have a parade or march or do anything. And the Supreme Court's bound that no, when it says no law, that's what it means, and that means if the Klan wants to march and hold a rally, they can do it. And John Stuart Mill says that it's better to let them do their thing, because if they have all these bad ideas and they want to express them, the solution is for people who have the better ideas to say, hey, you guys are a bunch of knuckleheads and here's why, and to persuade people that the Klan is wrong. And even like a Klansman might get the error, he might get the benefit of being corrected. You might. So if you allow people to discuss things openly instead of having the government try to censor one side, which is deemed as bad, then you're going to benefit society. And so anytime you're talking about social benefits, you're thinking in utilitarian ways. There's a bunch of workshops going on about the ad drop deadline coming up next Friday, about when you should change to pass, no pass, when you should be letter grade, how to make those decisions. And those are going on, I think, early next week. I got a flyer, which I'll post to Moodle right away. And speaking of Moodle, so I did, I may have said this already, I just got the topics up for this week. Apologies for getting them up late. I'll give you until next Wednesday to post. So if you want to slack off, just don't forget and say, oh, on Sunday, oh, okay, I have till Wednesday. Why should I do it tonight? And then, you know, Thursday morning, say, oh, crap, I forgot. There was like, I had to do that by Wednesday. So, but if you want till Wednesday, you can have it. But if you can post by Sunday and that's your habit, it's probably best to do it earlier, but you can have till Sunday, and I'll put a little note there in the forum as well. But those topics are up, and thanks to John for alerting me about that. Just all sorts of stuff going on. Okay. So we're talking about Kant, and we had just gotten to Kant's categorical imperative. So far we've been talking about imperatives, and an imperative, again, is a command you give yourself. It's a kind of a policy for action, and there's two kinds, right? There's hypothetical and categorical imperatives. Hypothetical imperatives are practical guidelines to tell you how to achieve some goal, and note that this is the kind of reasoning, this means-end reasoning, trying to figure out what causes what. It's the kind of reasoning that you have in utilitarianism. In utilitarianism, it's all goal-oriented reasoning. That's why utilitarianism is called a teleological theory. It's a theory all about, it's all about the results. So it's a I should write it teleological. This is going to come up with great Aristotle. Somebody in the back turn off their lights up front here for me.
Results focused, or purpose driven, goal oriented.
So the Greek word telos just means end or result. It's a goal. It's what you're aiming at. And so a teleological theory is a theory which is aimed at some goal. And the means don't matter, only the ends matter. And so you have this, I mean, one way of describing utilitarianism is, there's this phrase that you've probably heard before about something justifying something.
Means justifying means.
The ends don't justify the means, right? Maybe you've heard that. So what would be an example of the phrase, the ends justifies the ends doesn't justify the means? What might be a context in which someone might apply that and say, the ends don't justify the means. You can't do that.
Torture,
great example, right? So you're going to waterboard somebody. I saw the SpongeBob episode I was watching while I was away on the weekend. They had SpongeBob off, and they had that crab guy. He was like all tied up, and they're slapping him around, trying to get him to talk. I'm not sure what information they're trying to extract from him. But and the idea is that they want him to tell them something, but he's not talking. And so what do? They kind of slap him around, and then they take his prized possessions, including his coffee maker, his cappuccino machine. They're like destroying them in front of him and say, "Yeah, how'd you like that? Now I'm going to destroy this thing." And finally, he sort of breaks down and cries, and then he's still not talking. And then they realize that whatever they want information they want to get out of him, there's some big misunderstanding. They're torturing him for no good reason. But that being aside, if you have something you want someone to talk, they're not talking. The idea is you can use whatever means necessary to obtain that goal. Now, probably with that crab guy, I forget what his name is.
Mr. Crab.
Mr. Crab, okay. How could I forget?
Mr.
Crab. So, maybe in the case of Mr. Crab, it's sort of maybe not a good reason. But what if somebody knows where a nuclear bomb is? And you're Jack Bauer, and you're going to make the guy talk, and you get his face and say, "Tell me where the bomb is!" The guy spits in your face, right? What are you going to do? Well, you're going to torture him, and then you're going to pretend to kill his kids and see if you can get him to talk. And even, in the 24 episode, I thought it was kind of lame that they really didn't kill his kids. It was all a fake out. They had this terrorist, and they had this closed-circuit TV where they appeared to bump off one of his kids and then threatened to kill the younger one. They killed, the kid who was, 13, and they had, the little 7-year-old, and they were going to blow him away, and finally the guy talked. And then they brought in, the mom and the kids, and the one kid is okay. And it was all a game, so they didn't really kill him. But imagine, if you really had to do that, right? You didn't have the time to set up this elaborate psych-out theater. And you have the guy, he's not talking, you got his two kids there, what would you do? 10 million lives are weighing in the balance. And so a utilitarian would say, well, even though these kids are innocent, and they don't, they're too young to be accountable for, even if they agree with their father who they look up to, even if they're a little terrorist in the making, they're not really responsible for what he's doing, but they're a way to get to him, and nothing else is working. So what do? Well, you torture the kids, you might bump one of them off and threaten to kill the other one, whatever means necessary. Kant would say, no, the ends never justify the means, and it's always wrong to torture little children, even if millions of lives are weighing the balance. And even if it means that a bunch of other children are going to die in horrific, painful ways, too, right? I mean, it's not just these two kids. It's that if you don't torture these two kids, there's going to be millions of other kids who are going to die a slow death of radiation poisoning. They're going to be instantly incinerated. They're going to get radiation burns, right? So it's not like it's not like no children will suffer. But you come back to this distinction that Kant would take seriously between doing harm and acting so that harm is allowed. And remember, when we talked about utilitarianism, there's no difference between doing and allowing because all you're focused on is the consequences. Well, for Kant, doing and allowing is really important. You can be held responsible for what you do, an act of causing harm for someone. Allowing harm is a lot less, isn't as bad. You can allow harm and still be within your rights and have to have done the right thing. If you refuse to torture someone and allow a city to be, destroyed by a nuclear bomb, and the only way you could avoid it was by torturing someone, Kant would say you've done the right thing, even though the consequences are really bad. Okay, so hypothetical imperatives are the kind of imperatives in utilitarianism that where you're focused on creating the greatest happiness. Kant talks about these as being oriented towards desire. So remember, Kant says morality isn't about desire. Desire is about just sort of getting what you want. And Kant recognizes that in the normal events of life, it's okay for you to pursue your desires. But your desires are all selfish. So if that's all you've done, you're an immoral person. So categorical imperatives, again, are these absolute rules that make up morality. Morality is solely composed of these. Don't cheat, help people in need, keep your promises, don't kill innocent people, right? And they all take the forms of a categorical command, no matter what. And remember, categorical means sort of regardless, without qualification. So the categorical imperative is an imperative that you have to follow because morality demands it. And it doesn't matter what you want, it doesn't matter what the consequences are, you have to do it. Okay, so that's all review from last time. So now there's something called the categorical imperative. So what is Kant, when Kant talks about imperatives, categorical and hypothetical, he talks about the categorical imperative. Well, this is like the single principle that unites all the individual imperatives. So the categorical imperative is, say, it's the unifying moral rule that ties all these things together. So last time somebody asked, well, how does Kant know what's right or wrong? How does he figure out, in particular cases, what the right thing to do is? He says these rules are derived from reason, and that they don't depend on desire. But how does he come up with the rules of morality? And he does this in a couple of different ways. Well, actually, four different ways. We're just going to look at two. And he thinks that this is really the same principle, it just can just be stated different ways, and there can be different tests for a particular principle to see whether it's valid or invalid. And so we're going to look at two different formulations of the categorical imperative. So a formulation of the categorical imperative is a way of stating it, which acts as a test. So it's a way of stating the one rule of morality, which can be formulated or stated in different ways, and that formulation or statement of the rule will also act as a test for any moral principle you might put forward. Is this a good principle or a bad principle? Well, let's look at a formulation of the categorical imperative. And if the formulation says it fits, if it goes to the test that the formulation states, then it's a correct moral principle. So you'll see how this works in concrete terms in a second here. Oops. We got that. So each formulation acts as a test. Try not to go too fast here. Wish I had more room on the slides. The screen really looks kind of washed out. Mm-hmm. Okay, so first, Kant's has this obscure terminology, and Kant's style is kind of difficult. I think his ideas are really worthwhile, but it's difficult to read, so I apologize for that. And you can look at different translations of Kant, and they all pretty much read the same way. And it's not just translation; it's the style that Kant writes in. It's kind of difficult. It's funny that when I was in graduate school, people were thinking, "Oh, let's learn German so we can figure out Kant, because the problem must be just these English translations are confusing." Meanwhile, there were German students who were trying to learn English because they were under the impression that the English translations of Kant make them so much more clear. So, it's not a language problem; it's just Kant's style. But the ideas, I think, are pretty clear. Even though his style is kind of jargony, I think the ideas are kind of basic ideas of morality and some pretty profound and worthwhile. Unlike a lot of other philosophers who are sort of German philosophers, we'll look at Nietzsche later on. The rest of the German philosophers, I'd say, life's too short to read Hegel or Heidegger. Schopenhauer, unless you really like sort of gloomy, depressing literature that uses terms without meaning, but Kant, I think, was one of these philosophers who's really very careful about his reasoning, and even when he's wrong, at least he states his views in a fairly clear way once you sort of figure out what he's on about. You try to read Hegel and you trying to figure out what he means by absolute spirit or phenomenology or any of this stuff, and you're just left with a big question mark. And Kant, at least, if you work at it, you can figure out what he's trying to say, and it's kind of worthwhile. Okay, so the first principle, so a maxim. A maxim is a principle of action. And so it's a moral principle that you would act upon, like whenever I'm in debt, I'll lie to my best friend to get some money. Or whenever I see someone in need, I'm not going to help them unless I can get something out of it or something. So it's just sort of a general policy of action. When someone asks me a favor, I'll ask for a bigger favor in return. Otherwise, I won't do the favor. So, and he says, you should only act on a maxim that you could will to be a universal law. So, simply put, you should ask the question, what if everybody did it? What if everybody acted on this principle that I'm about to act on? So he thinks for every individual action, there's some abstract rule that that's a part of. And even if these aren't conscious, people have these sort of rules of action. So if, I'm driving down the freeway in the rain, and I see some guy by the side of the road, and he's like got these jumper cables that he's waving as I'm coming up on him, and I just keep on driving by, and I say, well, I'm going to stop. I want to get home, watch Glee, whatever it is. I don't have anything. Any place I need to be. There's no emergency. I just have something that I want to do, and I don't want to spend time getting wet and standing out in the rain helping this guy, right? I keep on driving. Well, that represents like a general principle that whenever I see a person in need, I will put my convenience over his misery or whatever. And so I have some kind of general principle of action about, I won't help others in need unless I can get something out of it. So maybe I pull up and I'll say, you need a jump? And he says, yeah, thanks for stopping. I say, $100, you got $100? It's got to be cash, right? And he says, I don't have $100. And I go, how much you got? He pulls the wallet. 17. Sorry, it's not enough. I just keep on driving, right? So, that would still be part of that general principle.
You got some nice shoes there.
Yeah, there you go. Maybe I'll take Barbie or something. And these rules might be, complex, but there's a general idea that I'm not going to help people unless I get something out of it. Kind of like an egoist, right? So now the question is, what if everybody did this, right? Why is this a good test? Well, Kant says, if you think about morality, whatever morality is, it's universal. It doesn't make any sense to think that you have one set of moral rules, I have another set of moral rules. He thinks that one thing that defines morality is it's the same for everyone. So if morality really is the same for everyone, and if it really is derived from reason, then any moral principle has to be something such that you can imagine everyone doing it. Otherwise, it's not a truly moral principle. So he gives an example of the false promise. So he says, imagine you're like in debt up to your eyeballs, and maybe they're coming to break your legs or not going well. You're going to go, I suppose in Kant's time, you're going to be thrown in debtor's prison. So you go to a friend and you ask to borrow the money and promise to pay him back, even though you know there's no way in hell you're ever going to pay him back. So you make a false promise, if you give me this money, I'll pay you back. I have some money coming in from an investment or whatever, and I'll gladly pay you Tuesday. Right? And your friend, under false pretenses, gives you the money and lends it. You pay off your debtors, or your creditors, so you don't go to debtor's prison. And then your friend is sort of on the hook for the money, and he's never going to get paid back. And maybe that he's kind of a nice guy. He would never send you to debtor's prison. That's why you borrowed the money from him. so Kant says that, you know, is that act universalizable, or is the principle that act represents really, is that universalizable? Could you imagine everyone doing the same thing in the same circumstances? So, and what he says is, you can't imagine a world where everyone acts on this maxim. Now the question is, why not? Why couldn't you imagine a world of liars and cheaters and people that made bad false promises and would, like, pull the wool over people's eyes and so on? What would happen, like, if everyone in the world, whenever they needed to borrow money, they would just lie to get it? And, or you might make it more general, where people lied to get what they wanted. They go to their friends, they just tell them a story, they make a promise they had every intention of breaking. A world full of promise breakers.
Everyone would stop giving stuff.
Yeah, in a world of promise breakers, there would never be any promise keepers. And after a while, Kant says a promise would be like a joke. He would say, you know, people would laugh, like you'd say, hey, can I borrow some money? I'll gladly pay you Tuesday. Right, you know, and you both laugh about it. And then maybe you talk about collateral or something like that. But no one would ever borrow money on the basis of a promise. A promise would be worthless. It would be like a joke. You know, if you'd be like saying scouts on or something. When let me think of a good contemporary example. Here we go. This is a great example. You ever heard, the check is in the mail, right? That's what it would be like, right? It would be funny. I promise, right? And the reason that's funny is because people say that, and they say that when the check is in the mail. The check is never going to come.
That's weird. I mailed it yesterday.
Okay, there's a follow-up, right? So Kant says, if you try to imagine a world where everyone does it, you can't. So he calls this a contradiction in concept. And he says, if you can't imagine everyone doing it, it's not really a moral principle. It's contradictory, because on the one hand, you're saying this is a principle of morality. On the other hand, you say not everyone can do it. So if you can't imagine everyone do it, but it's supposed to be a universal principle that everyone can do, then there's a contradiction. You're contradicting yourself. It's like saying, I am not speaking right now. Right? In the very act of speaking, I'm contradicting the statement that I'm not speaking. So in the same way, saying this is a universal principle of morality, but not everyone, I can't imagine everyone doing it. That's a contradiction. So, and I think Kant thinks this is really a kind of a formal contradiction. So sometimes people argue about whether this is like really a contradiction, or just kind of it's kind of weird or it's hypocritical. But I think Kant thinks this is really a logical contradiction. You're saying this is a principle of universal morality, and that's, you know, redundant, because all morality is universal. That's what defines morality. And you can't imagine everyone doing it. So therefore, if you can't imagine a world where everyone does it, it must be immoral. So you know that you can't do this. So you know it's wrong. Questions or comments so far? So this is what he calls a contradiction in concept. You couldn't even imagine a world where everyone does it. Therefore, it's got to be wrong. Some other examples. Suicide. So could you imagine a world where whenever anybody was miserable, in dire straits, or depressed about their life, they would kill themselves? What do you think?
Could I imagine?
Can you imagine a world of suicide? Put it that way.
Wouldn't we all be dead?
Well, there you go. It wouldn't last very long. So you can imagine a world where everybody, whenever they felt depressed, killed themselves, because everybody gets depressed sometimes, so nobody would be left. So again, Kant would say, because you can't imagine a world where everyone kills themselves when they're depressed, it's a contradiction, again, a contradiction concept. So it's wrong to kill yourself. And maybe this one's easier, like the murder, same thing, right? It's up for there. You're not killing yourself. You're killing the guy next to you. Whenever you're angry with your brother, you will murder him. Or whenever you get upset at someone, you try to kill him. So there, Kant would say, in a world of murderers, pretty soon nobody would be left. Theft. This is kind of a tough one. So could you imagine a world where everyone steals?
Sure.
Where everyone steals all the time, whenever they want something.
Including the government?
Yeah, they'd probably do it better than anybody else.
It'll just turn into a world of murder.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe that's a good point. Maybe you'd have people fighting over things and they'd end up trying to kill each other. That government comment reminded me of a sign that I made that said, it's a slogan that's been around. It says, thou shalt not steal. The government hates competition.
That's right.
Waving my sign at the Tea Party. So, what does he say about these above principles? Again, they contain contradictions in concept. And some of these might be controversial. What Kant would say is that in a world where theft is a matter of course, private property loses its meaning. There is no such thing as private property. If objects are picked up and appropriated at will, you know, unless someone's holding on to them for dear life, and even then, you know, somebody might grab it and try to tug it away, there's really no such thing as private property. And you think about this like bicycles. Think about a world where whenever anybody needed a bicycle, they looked for one to ride. And I suppose at first they'd be like locked up, right? But then everybody just carry bolt cutters around, right? They see the bike, they cut the bolt. After you get your bike lock cut 10 times a day, pretty soon maybe you wouldn't bother to lock it up, because instead of going for this bike you're just riding, you're like, well, here's another one. He stole mine, I'm going to steal his. Pretty soon, nobody ever really owns a bike. It's just that there are all these bicycles here, and you just grab one wherever it is. And so this whole idea of property, you know, property sort of would disappear. That the very notion of owning something would disappear. And so in a world where thievery went all the time, eventually, you know, there would be no property to steal. It would just sort of be borrowed, I guess, or shared. That might be a kind of a harder sell, but this is kind of what he's thinking, that in order to have a notion of property and theft, you need most of the people to accept that this concept of mine and yours. Otherwise, you couldn't really have stealing, because in order to have stealing, you need some robust notion of this is mine and this is yours, and we have a right to our own property. There's probably some joke you could make about John Lennon's song "Imagine," where he's talking about imagining a world without private property and government and so on, but I won't go there. So now these generate what Kant calls negative duties. So a negative duty is a duty not to do something. So because you can't imagine everyone killing themselves, you have a duty not to kill yourself. Because you couldn't imagine a world where everyone commits murder, you have a duty not to commit murder. Because you can't imagine a world where everyone steals, you have a duty not to steal. And why? Because you can't imagine, there's a contradiction in concept. You can't have a universal law that says do something that not everyone can do universally. So far so good? Questions? This is, you know, we'll get through this, and we'll try to go through this one more time, because this is kind of, it's, you know, Kant's a little bit elaborate here, but like it makes intuitive sense. Okay, another example. The rugged individualist. So imagine, could you imagine a world where nobody helped anybody unless they had something to gain? And Kant says, yes, you could. Some people say, well, of course, that's the way the world is. But Kant says you could imagine a world like that. So the idea is, again, like going back to the guy with the jumper cables waiting in the rain, right? If he doesn't have the payola or the cash or something of value to me, I just keep on driving. And so now the question is, okay, you can imagine a world like that, so there's no contradiction in concept. But then Kant says, would you want to live in a world like that? As a rational person, would you want that to be the world that exists, that you have to live in? So what do you say? I wouldn't want to live in a world like that. I've relied on the kindness of strangers, you know, on many occasions. I've been broken down by the side of the road myself. My car died on me, and some guy pulled up and, you know, gave me a ride to the gas station, and he's very friendly, so I was grateful for the help. He didn't ask me for any money. He had this Christian radio station on, but he didn't even try to preach to me or hand me a tract or anything. He was just there to help me. And so that was kind of cool. And he dropped me off at the gas station and went on his way. Didn't get anything out of it. And so Kant said, it benefits you as an individual to live in a world where people are kind to each other, where people help one another out. And so even though you could imagine a world like that, you wouldn't want to live in it. So now he says, you can't, and this is a kind of a unusual way of putting things, you can't will such a world to exist consistently. So here, the contradiction in will isn't as much of, it's not really a formal contradiction like the contradiction in concept. It's kind of a contradiction in your actions. Because on the one hand, you want to get help from other people, but on the other hand, you you don't want to help anybody else. So he says that every time you act, you're creating a world of, you know, in that first example, as I speed by, you know, I'm leaving that guy to his rain slicker and jumper cables, you know, I'm creating a world of selfish bastards, right? And so I'm willing there to be such a world where nobody helps anyone by not helping that poor guy. And so he thinks it's inconsistent because if I were there by the side of the road, I would want help. But I'm not. So, if you want to accept help, you should be willing to give help because your actions are going to have this effect in the world. So he sees this as sort of inconsistent.
What goes around comes around.
Yeah, I mean, that's the view that a lot of people have, that if you do good, good will come back to you. I'm not. Is that really the way the world works, though? And it's not necessarily. I'll just leave this for a second. It's not necessarily that your action is going to, like, you're helping someone else is going to cause someone else to help you. So, suppose, like, the guy that has helped me by the side of the road gets broken down. It could be that people just drive by him for hours and nobody stops. His helping me isn't going to have any causal effect on whether he gets help.
I thought you think he'll help somebody else later. Because of your kindness.
Yeah, so if I help someone, they might help somebody else later down the road. But they're not going to help me. Probably not. I mean, it's a big world, right? I mean, if you're in a small town, that makes sense to do favors for friends. But the idea of helping a stranger in a strange place is different. So there's no sort of cause and effect going on there. So the question is, why should I help a complete stranger? I mean, maybe I can help my friend because I think that even if I'm not trading tit for tat with my friend, even though it's not like, I lend you $20, you do something for me, you know, this sort of back and forth. But it might be, hey, you know, my friend wants to borrow some money. I know he's good for it. He pays me back. And then down the line sometime, he helps me out with something. And I'm like, it wouldn't necessarily involve, like, money. It could be that he's hears about, you know, some opportunity that you think would be great for me, and I just come to mind and we have this relationship. So that makes sense, but why would I help a stranger? And what Kant says is, he says it's inconsistent to expect help but not be willing to give help. But is that really a contradiction in the same sense as the other one, where you can't really even imagine a world like that? It might be hypocritical, but what's so bad about hypocrisy? Sorry, just something to think about. Anybody have any thoughts? Like a contradiction is like A, not, and then not A and not A, right? Formally and logic.
A and not A.
It is both raining outside and not raining outside, the same way in the same respect. This ball is both red all over and green all over at the same time in the same respect. That's a contradiction. This is a universal principle of morality, but I can't imagine everyone doing it. That's a contradiction. I like it when people help me, but I don't like it helping other people. Is that a contradiction? That might be a point of criticism. So what he says about this, though, is that these contradictions in will, where you sort of can't imagine everyone doing it, where you can imagine everyone doing it, but you wouldn't want to live in a world like that, generate positive duties. So you have a duty to help people in need, because everybody needs help sometime. I suppose, like, Kant might put it this way. If you're a rugged individualist and you're there's like an animal in the road and you swear to avoid it and you end up in a ditch and maybe you try to crawl out of your car and you slip down a muddy mountainside into a hole that's filling up with water. And you're trying to crawl out, right? It's not the same guy with the jumper cables, but somebody else, right? So, and there's someone that says, hey, you need some help to get out of that mud hole. It's filling up with water and looks kind of dangerous, like you might drown or something. And you're like, yeah, please help me. And you got $100? Like, damn it. Maybe karma is real, right? But you run into some a problem like that, and then you think, well, in order to give help, you want there to be a world where you can get help. And if you think, no, I want to get out of this hole myself, even though there's no way you can do it, you're just kind of crazy. I mean, you're irrational. It's like, if you're going to be a total rugged individualist, like, it's kind of like some of these people, like, you get some guy who's like, loses his job and he's holed up in his mountain cabin with his kids and they like die of starvation because he's too proud to take welfare or charity. That's irrational, right? It's irrational to not be willing to take help no matter what. And so because everybody requires help from other people sometime, you have to be willing to give help, according to Kant. So you have positive duties include also duties... we'll just take it. Here's another example of something that generates a positive duty. Kant says you have an obligation to develop your talents. And he says, could you imagine a world where nobody develops their talents? Where everyone did as little as possible just to get by. They were looking for some menial job that would just put food on the table so they could, watch TV and eat potato chips and sleep all day. And you'll have some heat, I suppose, and maybe running water and indoor plumbing. So could you imagine a world where everybody did as little as possible just to get by? Yeah. Now the question is, would you want to live in a world like that?
Does that mean that I have capacity to help you then?
You mean to be more ambitious than them?
Yeah. Because if I'm imagining that I'm living in that world...
It's like the man who would be king or something like that? Or the kingdom of the blind? The kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. You're the only one with ambition. Well, think about what a world like this would be, right? Would you have an iPhone or an iPad? No, you'd be like sock puppet theater be your entertainment, right? And it would be really bad scripts. There wouldn't be any scripts. It would all be improv. And writing a script is too much work. So it'd be like, you know, your friends and family members. You'd be basically, people would probably be like drinking and taking drugs and like laying around and not doing too much. Writing bad poetry, maybe. That'd just be horrible, right? So there'd be no great entertainment. You think about all the great works of art and literature and all the technology and conveniences and modern medicine and dentistry. I mean, all that stuff relies on people working their asses off and like going through years of school and really developing and finally tuning talents. Like think about just going to the dentist. I mean, that takes years of training, and you got like some tooth problem, and you're so grateful there's some guy. I got this guy, Dr. Backer, in Cosgrove, and he's awesome. And he's just so professional, and he's got a good, you know, chair-side manner. And when I get a problem with my tooth, he just, you know, fixes it right away. No pain, and nothing falls out. His work is as good as gold, you know, and it was gold crowns, right? And it's great. And so to think about, like, imagine, like, what a world, like, without people with highly developed skills like that. You see, you have like some toothache. You'd be like Tom Hanks on a desert island, right? You'd have your friend, maybe you'd be looking around for a piece of twine. You could tie it to it and tying it to the doorknob. And like, hoping the doorknob doesn't fall out instead of the tooth when you slam the door. So it'd be pretty awful place. So Kant says, therefore, you have a positive duty. Because you couldn't rationally will there to be a world like that, therefore you have an obligation to develop your own talents, skills, and abilities. So again, another positive duty. So contradiction in concept is going to give you a negative duty. Contradiction in will is going to give you a positive duty. So now let's take the principle. Let's see. Whenever I'm thirsty, I'll have a drink of water. Okay. So there's a principle. Now the question is. Could you imagine a world where everyone, whenever they're thirsty, they drink water? Sure, yeah. People might drink other things, but just to sort of simplify things. We don't have to want to qualify this to death. Okay, would you want to live in a world where anytime anyone was thirsty, they would have a drink of water? Sure, why not, right? So it passes both tests, so it's just morally okay. So there's certain things which aren't, you know, forbidden. They're not a duty. They're just morally okay. And so that just shows you, you know, that it's morally okay to get a drink of water if you're thirsty. And you could imagine like some other duties, like, well, you can think, you know, whenever I make a mistake, you know, I'll ask for forgiveness and try to compensate the person I wronged, right? So that's going to pass both those tests. That you could imagine a world where everyone did that. So then if it passes the first test where you can imagine everyone doing it, you can just stop there and it's okay. I think I put that wrong. So if you can imagine a world where everyone does it, it's morally wrong. You don't have to go any further. If you can't imagine a world where everyone murders, you don't have to ask yourself whether you want to live in a world of murders. Why? Because you can't imagine it, right? You can't ask whether you would like something which is impossible, or which is literally contradictory. But if you can imagine a world where you can do that, act on that principle, like if you can imagine a world where nobody develops their talents, skills, and abilities. Then you ask yourself, would you want to live in a world like that? And if the answer is no, then you have a positive duty to develop your talents, skills, and abilities. But there are things which are going to pass both the first test and the second test, and they're going to be morally permissible. They're going to be okay. So, and those would just be sort of ordinary things. Things that would be morally correct and morally right, like, I think of an example. Whenever I see someone in need, you know, I will come to their aid, unless it costs me a great sacrifice. Okay, could I imagine a world where everyone did that? Sure. Would I want to live in a world like that? Yes. Okay, so therefore, it's okay for me to act on my principle. Okay. Now, you know, what might, can you think of some criticisms of this? How about this? Whenever a bearded philosopher residing in the city of Cottage Grove but working in Eugene wants to steal money out of his colleague's desk drawer, he will do so. Could I imagine a world where everyone did that? Well, since the world where everyone did that would just include one person engaging in such stealing, namely, it turns out in the category I'm dealing with, the people who are allowed to steal out of their colleagues' drawers are bearded philosophers who reside in Cottage Grove but teach in Eugene. And I might say, you know, with the initials JB, say, right? To narrow it down, right? So if I make my maxim narrow enough, it's only going to apply to me, and then, you know, I can pretty much do what I want, right? And I could imagine a world where everyone did it. Would I want to live in a world like that? Yeah, it sounds great. You know, where every bearded philosopher with the initials JB is allowed, who lives in Cottage Grove and teaches in Eugene, is allowed to steal out of his colleagues' drawers. Sure. So you can create a maxim in that way, make it really narrow, and there's a way to kind of cheat and make it universalizable by the way you state it, and it's going to make all sorts of immoral things turn out to be moral. But, you know, I mean, it's kind of cheating. It's kind of obvious in that way that it's cheating. So I'm not sure that's a big, you know, argument against Kant. That's like one of the main arguments you could give against the categorical imperative. We can talk about some more later on. Let's talk about the humanity formulation, though. This might be something you've heard before. So the humanity formulation of the categorical imperative, again, this is another way of stating this, the categorical imperative, this absolute rule of morality. The first one was only act on those maxims you can will to be a universal law. This one says act so as to treat humanity as an end in itself and never merely as a means. Act so as to treat humanity as an end in itself, never merely as a means. So here, it's the basic idea that's wrong to use people. So to treat a person as an end in himself or herself means to take into account that this person has feelings and desires and autonomy or freedom. And you can't just treat them like an inanimate object. Right? If I come home from a hard day at work philosophizing, come over and I see a chair and kick the chair over, right, because I'm angry. Well, you know, who did I hurt? So it's the chair is there. The chair is not going to break if I just kick it over. You know, I don't really care about the chair. I can buy another one. And most people would say that's okay. If I come over and kick my wife in the shins, you know, that's different, right? She's a real person. When I kick her, she hurts. And it's going to make her angry or sad. And she has rights. And so Kant says, I can't treat her as a punching bag if I come home and I can't, like, engage in domestic violence because I had a hard day at work. That's morally wrong. So if I use my wife to get my aggression out, whether it's, you know, giving her a beat down or just yelling at her or even harsh words, that's wrong because I'm using her as a means to get out my frustration and anger as opposed to treating her as an enemy in herself. So it's wrong to use people. The same way with you, if you say, pretend to be friends with someone and really like them in order to get ahead, right? It's the way, like, Hollywood works. You pretend to be somebody's best friend and you hope you're going to be on their next movie deal. So you just can't treat people like tools or inanimate objects to get what you want. And so that, you think about, I think that's some other... And so you can't treat people as tools or inanimate objects. And you have to consider the goals and interests of other people. So when you're thinking, okay, what should I do? You think, well, it's going to involve, you know, interacting with people in certain ways. You can't say, oh, well, if I butter up Bill with compliments, maybe he'll, you know, maybe he'll go easy on me when it comes time to hand out grades. This idea of sort of manipulating people. If I tell Karen that her Wiccan religion is really fascinating and I'd like to join, you know, in order to have her sleep with me, say that it, even though I like it, in reality I think it's a bunch of superstitious nonsense and kind of kooky, right, then I'm doing something wrong. Because I'm lying to her, I'm pretending that I sort of value this thing about her when really I don't. And I'm using this as a tool to try to get some gratification. So that would, most people would think that would be wrong. Why? Because I'm treating her as a tool, as a means for my own pleasure. And we'll see. Khan actually talks about prostitution in this context, which we'll come to in a moment. In one way, the PowerPoint sort of keeps me on point. In another respect, I got to wait for the bits to go by so I can use my get to my examples without just sort of launching into them. So, okay, here's an example that you've probably seen in the TV and movies before, the jealousy plot. So, someone, usually a woman, recently broken up with her boyfriend, wants to get him back. So what does she do? She accosts some guy that she has absolutely no interest in. Somebody that her ex-boyfriend strongly disapproves of, maybe a geek, right? And maybe her ex-boyfriend's a jock. And so that seeing her with this geek and this nerd is going to make me really angry and thinking, I don't want that guy to have my girl, I want her back. And so once once Biff suddenly says, hey baby, why give you with this loser, and you know, sort of comes in and shows an interest again, then she drops the geek like a used Kleenex and is back with her jerk boyfriend. And so, does she care about the feelings of this person she's pretending to like and then drops, like, you know, like throws out like so much garbage, right? She doesn't care about him. She cares about getting her boyfriend back. She's using this person as a tool for her designs on her former boyfriend. You may have had a boss like this. He thinks that the way to get as much work of you as possible is to have you tremble in fear and terror every time you walk in the room. And he thinks if you're really afraid of being fired, that you're going to work extra hard. And you wouldn't dream of asking for a day off. And maybe he's just going to fire people randomly just to sort of strike more fear and terror into the working populace. And he issues irrational commands, maybe just to make your life miserable, so he can totally dominate you. Now, is he thinking about you as a person with, you know, feelings? No, he sees you as like a cog in his machine. He wants you to, you know, make those pizzas faster or whatever. Sweep faster, clean faster, wash those dishes faster. He doesn't care about you as a person. He doesn't care about the fact that, you know, it's your nephew's bar mitzvah and it's really important that you be there or whatever it is. That you're a student, you're trying to get through school and you have this really important test coming up. What he cares about is that you're there doing that menial job. And if you don't do your job the way he wants, he's going to replace you with someone who will. And so Kant says that it's wrong to act in that way. You need to treat your employees with dignity and respect. You can't treat them as just sort of like you would if you have a machine where one of the gears is kind of squeaking and you can't just kick the machine or kind of force it or, you know, just sort of act on it. Or maybe if it's not working, just throw it out. You need to treat your employees as persons. Theft and murder, again, are cases where you're treating a person as an end. So how would you treat people merely as means and not as ends in themselves?
drug cartel or something? So they just use people to carry drugs from places to another?
There you go, yeah. So you're using a person as a mule. Sometimes they call them mules, right? These people, usually they've got like maybe one of their family members hostage, or they owe the cartel a lot of money or what have you, and so they're made to do this high risk activity of carrying drugs over the border. But how is this might be kind of obvious, right? When you steal from someone, do you steal for the pure pleasure of the act of stealing, or because you really enjoy taking something from someone else? I mean, usually it's nothing personal. You just want their stuff, right? So it's like you point the gun at the person and say, your money or your life. And you hope this person is going to value their life more than their money, and they're going to hand it over to you, and you're going to be gone, right? It's not that you necessarily enjoy stealing. You just don't want to have to work for the money. And so there you're using this person as a means to your own ends. You're treating him merely as a means. You don't care for the fact that he's working some crap job at a pizza place, you know, and that he's got his measly $17 there, and it's all he's managed to save during the week. You don't care that he's about to be kicked out of his apartment, or all his personal stuff, or that maybe that the wedding ring you stole from some guy has a great sentimental value, and you don't care the fact that he's going to be in therapy because he's like freaked out and he's going to have post-traumatic stress disorder from being robbed at gunpoint. And if you ever had like a gun shoved in your face, you know, you talk to someone who's had that happen to them. It's not like something you sort of forget about and not think about ever again. It's something that comes back to haunt you. And even having your place broken into, that sense of violation. People have nightmares. People have horrible experiences that sometimes last for years from these things. You're not thinking about that person at all. You're just thinking, I want their stuff so I can go buy my drugs or whatever. Or I want to take their stuff because I don't want to have to work for the money. The same thing with murder, right? You're not thinking, my wife wanted to go back to school and be a famous artist, right? You're thinking, if I bump her off, I'm going to get the insurance money and move to Costa Rica. You're thinking of you. You're not really thinking of her as a person. You're thinking of her death as a means to you having a lot of money from the insurance settlement. Now here's like an interesting one: prostitution. So in prostitution, you have a client, you know, the John, using the prostitute's body for sexual gratification. And so it would seem that Kant would say that it's wrong because the prostitute is being, you know, objectified. She's not being treated as a person. You don't sort of sit down on the bed and say, hi, well, what's your name? You know, so how long have you been in the business? You know, so you really enjoy working here, you know, here at the chicken ranch or whatever. It's like, what do you want? You're there for your own pleasure, and she's there to service you. Now, you might make the argument of, well, the prostitute's getting something out of this arrangement too, right? She's getting the money. And she might be getting more money than she could get working some other job if she doesn't have, good work skills, right? It could be that it beats waiting tables. It might be that she can make, you know, more money in a night. Maybe she's going to college, saving up some money, right? So she's using the client also. Now what do you think Kant would say about that? There you go. So maybe it's doubly wrong, right? Because she's using him and he's using her. That doesn't like equal out. It's like twice as bad, right? Because there's two people treating each other as non-persons. So Kant says for this reason prostitution is wrong. Now here's here's an interesting question. What is Kant right about this, or is he just sort of a product of his time or of his pietistic upbringing? Could you imagine prostitution happening in a context where it wasn't necessarily wrong according to Kant's humanity formulation? Or is, I guess the question I'm asking, is prostitution necessarily depersonalizing? Or inappropriately depersonalizing?
Probably not. I have to say, probably not.
Sometimes you have, and necessarily speaking from personal experience, but there are people that go to prostitutes and they see the same prostitute every time they're on a business trip. They're on a first name basis. They know each other. They develop a relationship, and usually you get like men will sort of get in habit and will have a relationship with this prostitute. And it's not as if every prostitute is being beaten up and abused. Sometimes you get, especially like the sort of upper class escort services, right? They go out to dinner and maybe they're around clients, and then they have sex and the money's exchanged, but it's done in a mutually beneficial way, and there's no the client doesn't disrespect the woman. He might have the highest regard for her. Maybe she's really good at what she does. She's really good company. She's great with the clients, and he has a great time. And maybe he's kind of not very attractive. Maybe he's got a weight problem, but he's got a lot of money, and there's no other way that he would be able to be with such a beautiful woman this way. So maybe it's just a mutual beneficial relationship, and as long as it's done in a mutually respectful way, maybe that might be okay according to Kant. So this might be a case you can argue about whether it's necessarily depersonalizing, but you might think about cases in where maybe Kant's rule, if you were to apply it, really doesn't apply the way Kant thinks it is. Kant thinks prostitution is people using each other in an inappropriate way, that sex is this very personal and sacred thing. But you might look at it differently. You might just say, well, it's just sort of, it's not any different than some other exchange you might have in the modern world, a commercial exchange. Yeah.
So, prostitution is wrong if it's two people using each other for in the humanity formulation. If two people using each other, then it's wrong. But like you're saying, if they've got some kind of relationship, if their motives are unintended to use that person, then it's okay. Is that what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think so. It depends on the context. Like, okay, suppose I'm a racist and I like minority prostitutes, so I can have sex with them and make racial remarks and maybe slap them around a little bit and feel superior. And I'm like, so that seems like it'd be obviously wrong because I'm paying money to degrade another person. And suppose my motive is that having sex with a woman that I'm paying for sex makes me feel more powerful. That would reflect badly on me, and that would be wrong according to Kant. But if I can't get a date on a Saturday night, I have needs, I've got money, and I'm going to have a busy life, and I see a prostitute, and I treat her with respect, and don't abuse her in any way, don't have any bad, don't degrade her, and we have this exchange, maybe it would be okay according to Kant's view. I was just thinking of something else here. Okay, is it wrong to get a massage? Put it that way. Is it immoral to get a massage, like a non-sexual massage? Well, I mean, am I using my masseuse or masseur, right? Maybe, maybe my wife isn't really good at like rubbing my neck, right? And maybe, it's all stiff and I want to go get a massage, nothing sexual about it. Am I using that person? Well, yeah, I'm using their skills, right? They might be really skilled. They went to school to do this, right? And they have really strong hands and are used to, like, kneading muscles all day long, and so they're really good at it. Well, I mean, I suppose you could say I'm using that person, and the person is using me to make a living. What's wrong with that? I think Kant would say, again, his principle, it's using someone, it's treating somebody as a means only, or merely as a means, and not as an end in himself. So it's okay to use... It's okay to have an interaction where you get a benefit from someone. You just can't treat that person as only a means. Yeah.
So basically, if you're interacting with this person with goodwill, which is something that what Kant calls the only intrinsically valued attribute, is as long as you have the goodwill, I think you're okay, right?
Yeah, I think he would say that. So two ways I think of looking at prostitution. Now, one objection you might say, again, doesn't modern life requires some impersonal interactions. Imagine you're like, you're going through a fast food drive-up fast food window, and the person says, you know, hello, welcome to McDonald's, can I take your order, please? And you say, hi, how are you doing? Oh, I'm doing great, sir. Go ahead and give, what would you like? They treat you here right, and pretty soon, sir, it's not the best job in the world, but it pays the bills. Now, can I take your order, please? Pretty soon, people behind are like honking, you know. It's like, you've probably been behind somebody in the grocery aisle. It's sort of a chatty Cathy with the cashier, and they're kind of being slow and want to get the hell out of there. So I mean, modern life requires efficiency and these impersonal interactions. But I think that what Kant would say is that as long as, again, you treat the person with common courtesy and you say thank you and please and you're polite, that might be good enough. That's treating a person as an end in himself. If if you're nice, if you don't yell at the person for getting your order wrong, if you're not like, my brother was at a Taco Bell with a friend of mine, and they got his order wrong. They gave him like these three tacos that he didn't order. And so my friend takes these three tacos, marches up the counter, and takes the tacos and slams them on the counter, and cheese and beef are like flying everybody. He's like, can't you guys get my order right? You know, you guys always get it wrong. And my brother's like, I'll eat those tacos, you know, while he's going up to the counter. He's like, where are you going with those free tacos you just got? But my friend is just like yelling at the people for getting his order wrong. And that's the idea of, again, you know, venting your hostility against people, whether deserved or not, that you're using that person as a tool for getting your aggression out. He had mood problems, impulse control problems. Yeah.
So he was mad about free tacos?
He was mad about getting three free tacos, yeah. Like the hard shell kind, yeah. So, you know, my brother's like, yeah, I would have eaten those tacos. He thought about going and grabbing them off the counter there, and he thought it might not be too clean. But, yeah, so, but the idea is, you know, common courtesy is enough, and it's okay to have, like, an interaction with someone that's a kind of impersonal basis, as long as it's in a larger context. You're recognizing you're dealing with a human being, and you don't snarl or yell or treat the person like an inanimate object. Okay, so I think that's it for deontology, and topics are posted. We're going to start right in with Aristotle and virtue ethics on Monday.